Take a network break. Steep a hot cup of tea, visualize the perfect virtual donut, and join us as we puncture press releases and strip away the marketing malarkey to talk like real human beings about the tech industry. I'm your host, Drew Conry Murray, and joining me as always is my co-pontificator, Greg Farrow. Greg, how's it going?
It's been a long and challenging week this week. It just seems like, you know, the bits of society that send you papers?
Yes.
You know, like things in the mail and all that, they've been annoying the heck out of me. So I'm doubly grumpy today.
All right. Well, that'll be great for all the stories we want to talk about.
They don't make me grumpy. They're just stories. It's just stuff vendors made up.
Well, that's why it's so fun to be grumpy about it.
That's right.
All right, we're going to jump into all those good things, but before we do, I want to thank our sponsor for this week, IT Pro TV. You can enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code networkbreak30. Jumping into the news, we're going to kick it off with a look at the latest development in open networking. OpenSwitch, you may have heard about it. It's an open source network operating system originally created by HPE. It's now an official project with the Linux Foundation. If you haven't heard of the Linux Foundation, they've also got some other well-known products, projects like OpenDaylight, which is an open source SDN controller, OPNFV, which targets network functions virtualization for carriers, and Onos, which is the open network operating system project. Greg, are we getting into peak open source networking here?
I doubt it. I think it's still just getting started, to be honest with you. I think this is our foundation of the week. We've been joking about how many foundations we need to bring open source to fruition, and the OpenSwitch Foundation is a good one, I think. HPE has produced this. And what's unique about OpenSwitch compared to, say, Dell's OS X is that it includes the applications as well. That is, it's not only is it just an operating system that runs on a switch, it's an operating system that includes the apps, that is the routing apps, the spanning tree, the lags, and all that sort of stuff. It's a fair way down the path, whereas Dell's OS X initiative, and I recently wrote a blog post about Dell's OS X and looked into its architecture, Dell's gone with the approach of, here's an operating system based on Linux, but you would then go and pay for your routing app or your, you know, switching, or if you want MLAG, then you would pay for those additional apps to run on your switches in some sort of licensing scheme, which is a different way of monetizing, right? It's a bit like, here's my hardware, you pay for that, hardware comes bare, you can go and put Linux on your server, but the apps that go on top of your server more, you probably pay for those, like Red Hat, or if it's a Windows server, then you pay for Microsoft SQL Server. That's sort of the model that Dell's reaching for, I think. Whereas OpenSwitch is just open. Everything about the operating system and the apps for basic functions is just open. It's got a very conventional architecture, so it looks more like a Arista's architecture, if you're familiar, or a Cisco iOS XR architecture. It's got the SysDB and in there. It has a central bus and a central data store which contains all the configuration. So whether you're driving it by a CLI or API or other types of configuration engines, it just runs the same way. And that's a perfectly sensible way to design an operating system, you know, a product that you want to be able to use. And now that it's in the Linux Foundation, it's not a HP thing, like it's not a HPE thing. I think that gives it a chance to unlock and get other people involved. And, of course, as I joke with all the foundations, you know, if you go out and get a few buddies together, you can set up a foundation. The buddy list is included in the press release, and it's quite
interesting. Right.
You've got to have your buddies. There's no fun in creating a foundation without your friends, but it's a notable for who's there. So interesting companies like Barefoot Networks, Broadcom, Cavium, LinkedIn are there, which is interesting. That might mean that the LinkedIn networking team – would be interested in taking OpenSwitch as their operating system, and Quattro Networks and SnapRoute. So there's some very interesting companies attached to that initiative. Now the question is, can we see some other people join in, like Juniper and others, some of the bigger players or the more conventional players, to sort of get some convergence around an operating system that's like what Linux is to most people today, something that you can use.
Yeah, but the thing that I guess I worry about is that there's so much going on in the open networking movement that I worry about sort of a dissolution of efforts, that there's so many projects that people can be working on. Or are we actually going to get something real and functional out of any of these projects?
That's a risk. But then again, how many commercial vendors go under before they get a product into the market?
True.
It's the same thing, right? We have in the normal commercial market, you've got hundreds of startups competing to get a commercial product to market, and only two or three of those will survive. So in that sense, open source is running a similar sort of model. The advantage of open source, of course, is that you don't have the acquisition trauma. I was talking to a customer today who went out and bought, it was Mellanox. I was talking to Mellanox this week, and they're saying they're really excited about the open operating system thing because it means that customers can buy their switch and then choose a different operating system for different purposes. Maybe mm-hmm. you want to buy a Cumulus to get that BGP functionality, but then maybe you want the Layer 2 functionality. Well, maybe you use Mellanox's operating system for that. I think that's an interesting way of looking at it.
It sure is, and it definitely brings a lot of pressure to the traditional commercial suppliers like Cisco's and Arista's of the world.
Well, Cisco sells you the whole thing in a WANA, right? Which
yep.
is great, and there's a certain value to that because, let's face it, networking is not that huge compared to other parts. And really, if you don't want to waste time. You know, there's a viewpoint that you can take, which is you don't want to waste time going, and I want one of these and one of these and one of these and blah, blah, blah. It would be much easier if I just bought it all as a black box from one company. And mm-hmm. I had to have no problems with that, and I think that's a perfectly acceptable design decision and a business decision. But maybe you need more flexibility, or maybe you want to say Cisco's BGP stack is expensive, or it's not flexible enough, or it doesn't have these features, or it doesn't support this API. Maybe you want Chef support, or you want to run Core OS containers on there, but that operating system isn't certified to run, you know, blah, 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 all those sorts of things. I think it's time that we had these choices and people can exercise that and see what comes up.
All right. Well, we'll have a link to the project in the show notes if you want to go check out OpenSwitch if you haven't already and start playing around. Mm-hmm. Greg, you pulled in a story from Recode about some executive moves that Cisco, Mario Mazzola, Prem Jain, and Luca Caffiero were linchpins of Cisco's that spin-in strategy where they fund internal startups and then Cisco later buys them. Most recently, that was NCME. Mm-hmm. I guess these execs are being moved into advisory roles?
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? This is the people who've responsible for the Nexus 5000 to UCS and now ACI. That team has – way they've often done that is to – get a bunch of smart people at Cisco, highly motivated people, and then take them out to a startup that's 100% invested in by Cisco and mm-hmm. make a product and they come back. And then all the people who come back get rich. And it's been very divisive. So the article not only talks about the fact that these people have been moved to advisory roles, but also that the fact for the spin-out, spin-in model is very – caused a lot of internal stress. And a lot of people have departed this company because – they don't want to be missing out on the startup thing. So it's very damaging to Cisco's long-term, you know, staff stability. But also what happens is the products that come back in are brought in by people who aren't – they face a very difficult battle to be accepted by the mainstream of Cisco. And we've seen that most recently with ACI where the larger part of Cisco is fighting against ACI because they resent the fact that these people made out like bandits while the rest of Cisco just has to put up with this product, which has a load of problems – and a load of hassle associated with it. I mean, and the interesting thing about this is that people remember people's successes. They got bought for hundreds of millions. Nobody seems to be pointing out that every one of the products that these people brought back were buggy, unfinished, poor quality, and needed years of work to get them into a stable, reliable form. But hey, that's fine. It worked in the long run, right?
I guess so, yeah. Certainly for NCME, which Cisco bought for more than $800 million after investing like $135 million initially. So, yeah, that's I could see why that would create some internal conflict.
Yeah. So, you know, $700 million went to somebody.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they and put seed money into it. Even in the worst case, there was $200 million split between the employees of NCME at acquisition time. That's a pretty good deal for a lot of people.
That's a lot of Ferraris in the parking lot.
I think my problem is, of course, is that as a customer, I've been buying these products that these people produced. And quite honestly, if they went away, I would not be unhappy. I would much rather see a more mature and measured development cycle that focused on quality instead of quantity, which is where they've historically come from. Remember, we've talked a couple of times about this team not reporting to Chuck Robbins. They remained outside of the merger after John Chambers stood down. And now they've sort of been, you know, you could take a view that they've been forced to fit into Cisco. In other words, you're not allowed to be out there. You're either in or you're out, and they might have come in. I'd really love to know the scuttlebutt internally inside of Cisco about what came about here, because this has got all the hallmarks of we don't want to be a part of, you know, Chuck Robbins' Cisco, so we're going to report to John Chambers directly. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, you are either in or you're out.
Well, that's what I wonder, because when you move someone to an advisory position, and I'm making air quotes that you can't see, but that can swing two ways. One is sort of like a, you know, an august advisory strategist who offers big picture advice, and the other is just sort of a polite way of sidelining people.
Yes, and I think that this is them sidelined. I mean, these people don't need to work. They've done several major efforts. I'm not sure what their role would be inside of Cisco at this point in time. I mean, the future of Cisco is not in building enterprise products. I still hold that view. Cisco's engine for growth is not going to be in enterprise networking or enterprise products. It's going to be in other markets, IoT, analytics, private cloud type stuff. So, you know, or service provider. But I don't believe that enterprise IT is a growth market over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, a couple of other executive changes. Sony Giandani is being made boss of the NCME unit, and a senior vice president from the security group, a gentleman named David Goeckler, will now be in charge of enterprise networking.
I wonder if this moves, and I wasn't able to see this, but does this mean that the security and the enterprise networking business is merging? Because that would make a kind of sense. There's no reason for enterprise networking to be split up as heavily as it is. And I know there's another reorg this week in the technology. They're rationalizing the technology teams that build these products. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe this is a sign that enterprise networking is just part of something else. And it's not as important, as I've already said, as the future of IoT. Speaking of IoT, it reminds me I need to mention that IBM and Cisco announced a big IoT partnership this week. I'm not sure of the details. I didn't get a chance to review all of the documentation associated with that, but I think Cisco's looking for ways to go to market. I've said my view is at the moment that Cisco's bought this billion-dollar Jasper product to be an IoT platform, and now mm-hmm. it needs a way to bring it to market. Well, Cisco's resellers aren't the way to bring that product to market. They need to go and do deals with big companies like General Electric and so forth. And I just wonder if IBM is going to be Cisco's sales channel for its IoT product. So Cisco will make IoT. That is, it'll have a cloud back end and it'll have these networking products with IoT sensors and things like that. And then IBM's going to be its channel to attach to big partners in the world. Mm-hmm. Interesting times.
Very interesting indeed. And we're going to talk about IoT a little bit later. But first, we have some product news from Arista. They announced a new leaf switch series, the 7280R. The company's positioning it around IP storage, routing, and digital media. And the press release notes they're deep in abiding partnerships with folks like Nutanix, HP, and others who have converged and hyperconverged platforms.
Yes, nice to see Arista still producing new products, keeping in mind that in the Ethernet market, you do need to keep moving. And I've been wondering when Arista is going to produce something that's based around the Broadcom Tomahawk. Now, the press release doesn't make any note of who the merchant silicon is, but it all certainly looks and smells like a Tomahawk to me. I don't know about you, but
I didn't detect any smell, Tomahawk or otherwise, coming out of the surface.
So it looks like Arista's finally realizing that it needs to do something with the Broadcom Tomahawk. This seems a bit, if it is that, then it's a little bit late coming to market. Press release focuses on the fact that on its differentiating features. So a few things that Arista's got is the deep and intelligent buffers so that you can actually do intelligent and much better at low loss or lossless traffic flows across its fabric. Mm-hmm. That makes it interesting for IP storage. They also talk a lot about its flex route feature, which is the ability to do a form of TCAM compression. So only load into the TCAM the part of the routing tables which is in use. It's called FlexRoute, which is a very interesting. So that means that they can scale to very large numbers of routes. And now you can start to use these 1RU pizza box, which is from Arista, to do BGP edge routing, which is really interesting. But what I am concerned about, perhaps, is Arista's shoehorning a lot of features into this product. And I know that they've historically been very good at quality control and testing and producing software. I mean, part of their success is that their reliability and stability has been much better than their competitors, in particular Cisco, and that's why customers like them. But as they take on more and more products, my concern is that feature bloat in hardware tends to lead to quality degradation, and bloated products are usually broken products. And so I'm a little concerned both ways. I mean, it's exciting to see Arista focusing away from their chassis, because I think chassis are over, and getting some decent leaf switches out there with the right sort of capacity. But I'm also concerned that they're bloating it up, and that might cause problems in the long term.
That is always an issue as you have products and you add features, that you run into this problem of innovation and sustainability.
Mm. Well, keep in mind, you know, not only have you got features like FlexRoute, you've got NetDB, which is the distributed configuration engine. You've got VXLAN routing, which is a big one. This hardware will actually lay to do L2, L3. So as it comes off the VXLAN, you can hit an L3 edge and route it out. It also does BGP, VPN, and segment routing. So they've done a lot of work in the protocol code to get this stuff up to date, which is great. And this looks like a pretty standard Tomahawk switch, but they've done something around the buffering. Maybe they've enabled the validate, or maybe they've even done some fancy silicon in there. Who knows? I'm not too interested because I don't actually care so much. I mean, wire speed, 48, 10, 100 gig ports with flexible, when they call them flexible 100 gig, that means that they can be, each one of those 48 ports can be 10, 25, 40, 50, or 100 gig, depending on the breakout cable that you use. So good to see Arista coming to market with that product.
That's right. All right, and you had mentioned Mellanox earlier. You got a briefing on their Bluefield Intelligent Network Adapters.
Yeah, life isn't always about switches. You know, they plug into servers. Do you know that?
What are servers? What?
Servers. Yes, it's not. So Mellanox is a well-known maker of network adapters, and you don't often hear about network adapters because most people just go with the ones that are in their servers when they ship. And those people who've been buying Cisco UCS or HPC class or Dell R series, you know, those fancy servers, they actually have a high-performance network adapter in them. Most people just don't know. What they don't know is that that NIC is usually a high-speed network processing engine that actually does advanced networking functions. And the way that they work is they have this SOC system on a chip processor to multi-core engine to do all of the potential configuration options that are needed. So what Mellanox Bluefield is part of their EasyChip acquisition. They've got this SOC system on a chip. It's using a Telera ARM, which is a 52-core ARM CPU, which combines with a Mellanox ConnectX. So ConnectX is the silicon that goes inside of Mellanox switches. So you put one of each of those onto on a NIC, and lo and behold, you've got this massive performance network adapter for the future. Pretty amazing stuff. You really need to get into, if you know why you want one of these, you'll be really interested to hear more about it, I'm sure.
All right, well, we'll leave it there, and we'll have links so you can go get some more details.
Yeah, storage people should really be caring. That's the thing about that. The high-performance network adapters are a bit like fiber channel NICs. So if you're into this high-performance storage, maybe a Mellanox adapter is the thing that you should be looking for.
Okay, go take a look. Sticking with product news, Endace. They make network monitoring and recording products. They announced the new Endace Probe 8100 series. What's new here?
They're one of these companies that specialize in packet capture at scale and permanently. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you put one of their boxes in the network, you capture all the packets that go through. There's three or four companies in this space. Endace is one of them. But this one can now capture and store network traffic at a sustained rate of 40 gigabits per second, which is a lot of data being processed. So that you can then forensically investigate network security breaches and performance. So the idea is that you can actually capture packets at line rate and then play back an attack, or if you need to know if you've been breached and data is being exfiltrated, you can actually go in and play these back using this platform. It's a very unique product. I just wanted to bring it to your attention and say they're continuing to build these at a performance level that just makes my brain hurt.
That's that could be a tagline right there.
It probably could. I mean,
makes
think about this.
Thing. Hurt.
One of the probes. These are hardware devices. 8 1 gig/10 gig or 2 40 gig monitoring ports. So that's like wow, highly optimized SSD based RAID to deliver 40 gigabits per second write to disk rates. So that's a hell of a lot of data being munged right there.
That's right. Well, if you need to do some investigation, you can check out Endace.
Yes.
All right, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsor. This episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare for your IT certification. And Greg, you want to tell us a little bit more about what's going on with IT Pro TV?
Well, we all need a little training, especially if we're doing certification. So IT Pro TV is a company that has 1,000 hours of up-to-date video content there for you to get into some topics, and new courses are being added weekly. Courses are streamed live and on demand. As they produce the content, they stream it live, so you can watch it in production if you're around at that particular point in time, or you can play it back on just about any device that you like. Course topics vary widely: CompTIA, Advanced Security Practitioner, CCMP Security, Metasploit, and more. Sometimes it's one of the things I've done with these products is just go in and watch things that I don't know anything about and get learned from them. I'm never going to do the study or something, but I just jump right in and watch it and, you know, absorb stuff from the atmosphere about products that I don't know much about.
Yeah, get those details.
Yeah, it's not too bad, because when you pay one low monthly subscription price and a no-hassle cancellation policy, maybe what you do is go in and get started and just, you know, have a bit of a look around.
So check out itpro.tv/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 a year, but they have a special offer. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code NETWORKBREAK30, and you can check out their courses, live stream, and more. You also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account, so that's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Go check it out. We'll have a link in the show notes, and thanks to IT Pro TV for being a sponsor. Okay, getting back to the news, we mentioned IoT earlier, talking about Cisco and IBM getting in on the game. VMware doesn't want to be left behind. This week, the company announced a new project called LIOTA, which stands for Little IoT Agent. It is, guess what, an open source project. Hats off to VMware.
Where's the foundation? Where's the foundation? That's
right. Coming soon. Coming soon.
Coming soon, yeah. We've got to get something together before our friends will join in the fun.
And so as far as I can make out, LIOTA's targeting IoT gateways, which are the bridge points between the IoT devices and sensors and your backend systems like your analysis platforms or your management systems. And to quote the VMware announcement, LIOTA is targeted at developers who are, quote, building secure IoT gateway data and control orchestration applications. So that's the where, when, and how to gather data from attached devices and transfer that data to data center components. So VMware making a move in IoT here.
Yeah, it's comes down to this IoT infrastructure debate of how it's going to look. Is it going to look like your Apple Watch, for example? Like there's a type of retail IoT, isn't it, which dials home to somewhere in the cloud. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do it in the home, maybe you're going to have that box that connects to the internet, you know, your DSL modem or something like that. You're going to need some sort of hub to connect up all of the things like the light bulbs and the stove switches and the sensors and the house alarms and the door locks and all that sort of stuff that you're going to have. You're going to need a box that's going to run all of those things.
Right. And a lot of these things are using their own, their different protocols. It's not all uniform like an IP network necessarily. So you need also something to do that serve as sort of a translation layer as well.
That's right. You need something that's going to collect it. Now, Cisco's got the cloud platform. I'm sure they're working on one of these operating systems. It'll be called iOS something. An open source one is a way to head off your competitors at the pass, of course. And with VMware producing it, that's a good name that have a good experience with quality control. And I'm pretty sure they also don't want to see containers take it away. Containers is undermining VMware to some extent. It's mm-hmm. certainly possible to run containers in VMs, but it's not the most efficient way to do it, I don't think. There are reasons as to why you might choose to do so, but I don't think it's a long-term strategy. So we're going to see some interesting stuff here as, you know, if this is an operating system that sticks, that is, if, you know, what are they going to do to get adoption around this? It's not enough to, these days, building an operating system is easy. People seem to do that every other week. What is it about this that would attract people like Nest and Fitbit and, you know, and all these Amazon Echo to use these home hubs instead of make their own?
Well, it also could be, you know, they may be thinking more about the industrial sector where a factory or whatever has a bunch of sensors out on the floor but also need to communicate back to some kind of central analysis system. Mm. That's where the gateway would come into play. I think it's for VMware to get into IoT, this seems like a good place for them to go because, you know, what is it they're good at? They're good at, you know, inserting themselves in between the hardware and the software layers. And so this is also, you know, the gateway becomes an insertion point. They don't necessarily need to care about the operating system or the connectivity of the sensors or the back-end systems. They just insert themselves and do that translation. So at first I was like, VMware, what? But the more I'm starting to think about it, the more I think if VMware is going to be an IoT, this seems like the sensible place for them to play.
Yeah, but, you know, compare – where's the rest of the strategy, right? So, do you know what I mean? Like Dell has a box. So when we were at Dell World earlier this year, you and I went to Dell World, they released the keynote. They talked about the Dell 500, which was the hardened box that they were going to use for IoT. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is an operating system could go on that box. And in the press release that Dell actually has a thing going, you know, apps built according to the LIOTA framework running on Dell Edge Gateways give developers an opportunity to build powerful, flexible IoT solutions. Okay, great. But having the Edge and some apps on top of a box doesn't give me the back end in the cloud that I need. And Cisco mm-hmm. bought Jasper to give them that. And other companies have that cloud back end. So if VMware wants to participate in this market, which is just phenomenally huge, it's not enough just to have something at the edge. You've got to have something in the cloud, I think, to make this framework look valuable, right? Because that operating system.
Well, yeah. I mean, where folks like Cisco or others are going to extract value from IoT is not necessarily in the connectivity. It's in the data analysis and the data storage and capacity happening at the back end. So yeah, I see your point that, you know, VMware's got to have maybe more of an ecosystem play, a few more pieces. But as in terms of getting their toe in the water, starting off a little open source project, it's kind of low risk. It lets them sort of play it out and get a feel. And then maybe they'll work out a strategy as they go forward.
Yeah, maybe this is one of these things where you put it out there and maybe somebody will glom onto it and you can get somewhere with it. This announcement doesn't feel connected, if you know what I'm saying. It just, you know, it's one of those things where people sort of, you know, throw a $50 note on the table and say, look at that.
That's right. We need an IoT strategy.
Yeah.
Okay, like, here you go.
Where's the rest of it? You know, where's the rest of the – where's the apps? Where's the ecosystem? Where's the buddies gathering around to say how awesome it is? Where's the cloud black end that's going to take the data from this thing? Where's the apps?
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll see if they've got anything else up their sleeve coming down the line.
Maybe this is just the first step down that path.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Give them time.
Yep.
Some slightly confusing news coming from IDC around worldwide sales of video conferencing equipment. The most recent quarter was terrible. It went down about more than 20% from the previous quarter. But year over year, the market actually grew, although by a small amount, 2.3%. A note in the press release says that Q1 is traditionally soft, so the decrease isn't necessarily a surprise. And the annual sales do show growth.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of video conferencing, Drew. So,
me either.
So the first thing I read was, you know, the market shrank by 20%, which is probably catastrophic for some of the companies involved. I thought it was also interesting just how small the total video conferencing market is. For something that I get so many people saying video conferencing and QoS and, you know, it's got to do this and it's got to do that. The whole market's not even worth $500 million a quarter. That's a tiny, tiny market.
Right.
I mean, a substantial business overall. That's $2 billion a year's worth of business. But a $2 billion market shrinks 20% in a single quarter. And then IDC says, but don't worry about it. It's just seasonal. It's like, what?
Trust us. It'll get better.
Yeah. It's like, wow. That's you know, interesting part is apparently it's like, obviously, we think it's one of those things in the budgets where we've got some money left over. Let's buy some more of that video conferencing gear. Because it's old and rubbishy and we should replace it. It's not worked, so let's buy more of it and see if the new stuff works.
Well, you know, I'm not a big fan of video conferencing myself, and I do feel like it's an industry that's been promised to take off and never really has. Although I will say that I feel like I'm doing more of it in my work life. Like, you know, we use video for our own staff conferences, never done that before. So it is, I think, starting to creep in slowly, but it's not, you know, we're not at the sort of Jetsons, everything's on a screen, you're always talking to a face yet. And I don't know that I want things to go that way either.
Well, you know, over the years, I've used video conferencing in different businesses for lots of different reasons, and it just doesn't work. The software, flat out, like, you know, at one company, we used to have what we called the video conferencing 30. That was the 30 minutes ahead of the meeting that we spent getting the video conferencing working.
That's right. Can you see me? I can't hear you. I can see you, but I can't hear you. Oh, wait, I can't see you, but now I can hear you.
Now we'll have to dial your ISDN line or, you know, just what's the IP address of your video conferencing gateway and all this silliness, you know, just ridiculous stuff. I'm sure that they're working on these problems, but at the same time, people would much rather just use their iPhones or their laptops, you know, the video cameras. Skype video conferencing, you know, obviously is the one that most people know. Just why are we bothering with dedicated video conferencing equipment of any sort? Doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean all right, if it's a niche market, fine. But if it's a niche market, stop talking about it and just ditch it. Let's move on.
All right, moving on. We'll go with a little bit of financial news. Palo Alto Networks, they reported a good third quarter earnings, revenues of $345 million, which beat forecasts. The company is also predicting fourth quarter earnings are going to go up as much as 37% over last year's fourth quarter. That seemed like pretty good growth to me, but there was an article in Motley Fool that's just kind of raining disappointment all over the security vendors parade. And one reason for that disappointment, Palo Alto has been actually showing revenue growth of 50% or more quarter over quarter for almost 2 years. So when you start coming in under that 50%, Wall Street starts to get a little nervous.
Yeah, I think people thought the good times were going to last forever.
Why do they think that? It never does.
It never does. No, I read a different article to you on this point. And like you say, there's just, you know, massive growth with Palo Alto. And lots of people tell me that the Palo Alto firewalls are just brilliant. And, you know, they're really, really strong on them. Them and Fortinet, I know a lot of people like Checkpoint, but I've had many more people say they're exiting Checkpoint to turn around to Fortinet or Palo Alto. But then security products are like very trendy. They change from time to time. So it's interesting to see how it's going to go out. I think what you're seeing here is that Palo Alto just said, there's been an overall wholesale sell-off of security stocks, and I think there was a race into security stocks following Snowden and various breaches. And what people are realizing is that there's just not that much sales behind it. At the end of the day, enterprise IT's attention only on security only ever lasts for a year or two before it actually just we go back to more important things like, you know, getting work done.
Well, the Motley Fool also has some interesting data on how much Palo Alto actually has to spend to acquire customers and what its operating expenses are. And they are significant, which I think is the real key to Wall Street being a little bit down on Palo Alto. We'll have a link to that story if you want to go look at some of the gory details.
It's what you would expect, right? Palo Alto is a growing business with real products that are actually innovating. Checkpoint's a stagnant company that hasn't had a brilliant idea in over a decade. They just don't have to spend money. They're just, you know, harnessing existing customers and forcing the same old stuff down their throats.
No difference. Well, we never said Wall Street was rational in the way it makes these decisions about things.
No, I mean, to me, that looks perfectly normal. Palo Alto is growing its business. Checkpoint's just exploiting its existing customer base.
Sticking with some financial results, Broadcom has released its quarter two 2016 financial results. Greg, what jumped out at you here?
Just two things around this. One is that they said, this is the CEO, Hock Tan, talking. He said, demand for hard disk drives and premium smartphones was weak this quarter, but we had very strong product cycles from switching and broadband in a wide segment, enabling company revenue to come in line with revenue expectations. I think what they're trying to say, albeit indirectly, is that switching sales have replaced the sales from Apple's iPhone. So Apple iPhone sales were down this quarter. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of speculation that Apple was shrinking, and there was much wailing and gnashing of teeth and other stuff. And it'd be that revenue has been replaced by stuff in enterprise IT, especially around switching and routing and a few other things. So it's interesting to see that. The second part is that he specifically called out robust demand in switching and routing, standard products including very strong traction for our Tomahawk and Jericho routing engines. That's the chipsets that are used by Arista and other companies. So it'll be interesting to see. So Broadcom's obviously experiencing good, strong growth in that point. So we'll see how it works out from here. Nice to know that merchant silicon is a thing. It's not just a thing that's going to happen for a little while. That's what I'm seeing out of that.
It has legs.
It has legs. Well, it's not dying down. A lot of people would have thought that now that Cisco's in control, I've heard a lot of people say Cisco's in control of the market again. And this is sort of showing that that's, you know, merchant silicon isn't shrinking. It's growing, and it's growing at a very fast pace.
All right, our final story for today. In a recent episode, we had talked about how a private equity firm was in talks with Infoblox about taking the company private. Now there's a story in Bloomberg reporting that Infoblox has hired the investment bank Morgan Stanley. The article says the bank's been brought on board to provide some, you know, guidance around the buyout offer and maybe help value the company. Bloomberg is also reporting that Starboard Value, which is an activist investor firm, owns 7% of Infoblox. They're the ones pushing for the sale. And the likely buyer would be Thoma Bravo, which has a track record of taking tech companies private.
Yeah, which is it's always interesting, these sorts of things. But Infoblox has been having a lot of problems with companies lately, with takeover bids and various things. So it'll be interesting to see whether they can defend themselves against this, because it's a business that is quite vulnerable to a lot of different things. And they seem to have a unique set of problems, to be honest. But, you know, there you go.
Yeah, well, it's not clear if this is a defense or just, okay, let's get our house in order and make sure we make the most of this sale. But we'll see. Starboard Value is also the folks behind trying to get Yahoo sold. So they've got some clout.
Yeah, well, you know, the difficulty here is going to be who's going to buy the business. Somebody's made an announcement. I'm not sure why they would even want to defend themselves. You know, why are you defending yourselves against this sort of court case? You know, takeover bid, that doesn't seem to make too much sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. All right, well, that wraps up this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, how can they do that?
They can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters is @etherealmind.
And I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net, and you can find me on Twitter at @Drew_CM. Thank you to our sponsor, IT Pro TV, and you'll find all the links you need to learn more about them in our show notes. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes or share it with your friends. You can also check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You'll find those links at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.